Higo joined us on the phone right now. Good afternoon, Higo.
G'day, Mick. How are you?
Yeah, really good. Thanks for joining us here at 2SER.
Pleasure.
Almost exactly 4 years ago, you pasted that image of Alfred Cameron Jr. on the corner in Redfern. What are some of your earliest memories of glimmers of that idea coming about?
I think I was trying to figure out if a customer at a restaurant that I was working at the time as a waiter had a nut allergy. And then I had a moment of insight that I wanted to do art. And I was looking for a project, and I heard about the Coloured Digger March in Redfern, and I just dug a little bit deeper, and then I came across the poem Black Anzac, and that poem was the thing that sort of brought me to making the mural, and then eventually a time-lapse film with Tim, and then ultimately the film that's online on SBS's website at the moment.
Now, I'm a little bit confused. How does a nut allergy lead to you doing art?
I just didn't want to wait tables anymore. I was looking for some sort of, a project to do. Yeah. It was my first, I'd never done a mural before. I never knew it would turn into a mural, but, I was following a couple of artists overseas, and, I got, lucky enough to come across some people who would help produce large scale public artworks doing wheat pasting, which I do with a paper and glue. And they taught me how to do it, basically online, and never met each other before. And then I just then connected the dots with the poem and the book, Narrenjeri Anzacs, where I found Alfred's image. And it sort of blossomed from there. It just kept building. Every new week there was a new chapter, and then people just kept going dig deeper, and I kept finding these new things. And I eventually ended up choosing to wheat paste an image of this gentleman called Alfred Cameron Jr., I think he was one of 27 Aboriginal soldiers in this book, Narrenjeri Anzacs, by Doreen Cardinieri. And I just randomly picked his image and ran with it.
And it is a really striking image, and it's a very, clean-cut young man. I'm not sure how old he is in that photo, but it looks quite young, like a lot of the people that were sent off to war.
Yeah, I think he was in his early 20s from what I can recall. And it's great in the film, actually. When we went and visited his great-great-nephew, Peter Cameron, Mansfield Cameron, at Alfred Cameron's house that he grew up in, he showed us a photo of him when he was about 3 or 4, and he's standing exactly like he is in the photo when the army took his photo, which ended up being the mural. And that was just amazing that, 20 years later, he's still standing. He's got that really striking stare straight into the camera. It was really interesting. It's a very striking image indeed.
It sure is. And I love how in the documentary you sort of document some of the reactions from people who, when they first saw it go up and looking back and going, wow, look at that. Do you remember some of the most vivid feedback that you received at the time?
We had problems, so many issues putting it up, his slouch cap, about 10 pieces, and that was like, the keystone for the whole mural. So I was preoccupied, and I didn't really see the reactions until, I was starting to decompress a couple of days later and looking at the reaction online. But I don't know. I think the biggest reaction to me was not necessarily reaction after the mural that stood out, but just the fact that there was a relative, a direct lineage to Alfred, Peter in South Australia, which the South Australian Museum connected me to. And I had to ask his permission as a final line of permission of many levels I had to do to get that mural up. And him just saying yes, and that he was really proud without ever meeting me or knowing anything about, really what was going to happen, and neither did I. I think that was just, a really good, if I look back, with 4 years of hindsight, maybe that was like the best sign ever for this whole project. I didn't know it at the time, but it's really blossomed from there. But I mean, a couple of days later, I think it was 24 hours later, a crappy iPhone photo had gone up online and been shared liked like 50,000 times. It's just the comments, I think, online that they're on public domain. They're on the record now. And majority of them were extremely positive. And a conversation had been sparked, not just by me, but by many different creatives working in this storytelling sphere. But I don't know if one stands out. Probably, to be honest, actually the most interesting thing was when this one didn't make the film, unfortunately, for the TV cut, maybe the festival cut, but my father brought out some old binoculars about a year and a half into making this film, and he said, didn't Alfred go, wasn't he in the third light horse? And I said, yeah, he was. He said, did you know that your great-great-uncle was in the third light horse?
What?
And we hit up the head Indigenous historian at the Australian War Memorial. He dug into the war diaries, and he basically said that some point, probably in Palestine, present-day Palestine, they probably crossed paths.
Wow.
And that blew my mind. I mean, and I picked, there's 27 Indigenous soldiers from World War I and World War II in this book. I've picked one image, and then it's turned into this big project, and then it comes full circle. And then one other thing that didn't make the film either, but it, we've also got footage of, is when we were in Meninji doing the final series where we end the film of all the soldiers from the book, this gentleman comes out with this handful of USB sticks, and he's like, Peter and Merrill, Mansfield Cameron, are like, you've got to speak to this guy. Pulls out his computer, smashes it on, and he says, there's about 1,000 photos here. No one's ever seen them before. They're taken with a little Kodak pocket camera, same scale, ironically, as an iPhone today. And a soldier in the third light horse carried that around with him. So I don't have a photo of my great-great-uncle, I've got, obviously, photos of Alfred. But somewhere in those thousands of photos of all these troops walking through the Middle East and whatnot, maybe he's Alfred and maybe he's my great-great-uncle. And that just blew my mind. And that was towards the very end of the filming of the film. So, I mean, I don't know where it's going to go from here. But, yeah.
I reckon we were talking about serendipity earlier in the show, and I think this whole process for you sounds very serendipitous. It was all sort of meant to happen. And I love that it's all been documented as well. Now, one of the things I know about this, well, I read about this, is that you didn't expect the artwork to stay there as long as it did. It's just paper and paste that you put on a wall. How long did you really think it would stay up there?
I mean, from estimates from people that had told me they'd done much bigger projects overseas, they said, you know, it could last a couple of weeks, it could last a couple of years.
Yeah.
But there's so many different variables, from the orientation of the sun to the, you know, to the harshness of the light, of the sunlight hitting it, to the wall surface, to the glue mix that you use, to the paper stock, to, you know, how thickly you apply the glue, if you seal it. There's so many variables.
Right.
But I think what makes it beautiful is that while a lot of people who aren't sort of in the sort of mural making world go, oh, it's a shame that it's disappearing, it's sort of nice that at least it lit the fire under, in my proverbial backside, to, you know, document it with photos first for social media, and then it turned from a time lapse into a film with Tim. And we would never have done the film if we knew that it was going to last. But I knew that I had to document it somehow. I just didn't know it was going to turn into a feature-length doco and be on SBS 4 years later.
Oh, it's so fantastic that it is. We'll tell people how they can get to it shortly. I live just around the corner from the mural, and I remember when it went up. I was trying to look myself in the background, actually, of the time lapse, but I didn't quite see it myself. But,
yeah,
you know, just walking past it every day, I always just love seeing it there. And I really miss it now because the building's been torn down that it was on. Have you ever thought about or had any discussions about erecting something similar in Redfern again?
I haven't particularly. I'd love to do another one of him if someone gives me a wall, especially in Redfern. I think for me, in my white fellow understanding and my research and living for several years in Redfern as a kid and then as an adult, Redfern's still, in my opinion, the most significant parcel of land in urban Australia, modern Australia, that's for Aboriginal people with the whole civil rights movement and whatnot in the 60s. So it'd be great to be in Redfern, but I think what some people might miss is that the mural of him in country, down in the Coorong, where he's actually from, that's still up. But I still would like, you know, at the same time, I'd like to sort of put a pause on it and just let people to look at the film, to motivate people to look at the film, because while you can't see the actual mural in situ, maybe that will drive people to look a bit deeper at the broader story of what we're trying to acknowledge, not just Alfred's story, but the Indigenous experience of, you know, many ex-servicemen and women, and more broadly, the history that we share in modern Australia of, you know, the wrongs of the past.
Indeed, as I mentioned earlier, you know, Indigenous Anzacs were treated very differently to the other Anzacs that came back from war, and people maybe don't realise that. So it's always interesting to go in and look at the history books and find out what actually happened.
Sure. Yeah, it definitely is. I mean, what a lot of people have said is that, you know, they they got, especially from the historical perspective, you know, they were treated as equal partners when they were in the conflict zone. But the reality is that when they did come back to the home front, they were still treated like second-rate citizens. One thing that was probably the most striking story that I heard was from a couple of sources. I don't have primary source proof of it, but I'm sure other people do, is that when the soldiers got off in Sydney or Melbourne, and they were Indigenous, apparently they had to find their own way home while, you know, the white fellas were, you know, arranged transport. You know, I don't think there's a lot of... What's interesting as well, why there's this negative history, there's still an overriding positive interaction that's coming from the Indigenous folk that I've met throughout this journey. And possibly the only negative has come from people who... you know, non-Indigenous who just think that I'm trying to separate the pack. But that's not what I'm trying to do. I think all I'm trying to do is just, with this particular work, and a lot of people are doing it with other mediums, is just to, I think they need some sort of separate acknowledgement, just like Tony Albert's sculpture in Hyde Park with a specific acknowledgement to Aboriginal service people. They just went through so much, and to not get that specific acknowledgement, I think, you're setting back the reconciliation efforts by another generation. I think the more that we can do now, in the various forms, you with radio, me with murals or whatever, I think we can start, you know, moving forward together. There is one other thing that I'd like to mention is this amazing word that I learned called Wiritjin, which is a word that originates from around the Coorong, which means white and black fellas working together. And what was really interesting was that that word came, I learnt that word from Alfred's relatives, and one of their, I think their nephew, has a radio program in Byron that's called Wiritjin, and black and white fellas working together, doing creative stuff, telling interesting stories of the past. And it was just a really striking sort of positive sort of cap on the whole story, that there's people willing to partner together to bring these stories out together. And I've only had nothing but love projected to me in reverse from Indigenous community while I've manoeuvred myself as a white fella through this whole journey. It's been really eye-opening, and I'd love to keep doing it.
Yeah. Have you been working on since that maybe people could see?
I've been doing, I did another film project straight after this one, or concurrently actually, in Philadelphia and Baltimore.
Right.
That's called Positive Movements, and it's about my body of work in Philadelphia and Baltimore, trying to amplify groups that are doing really positive stuff in neighborhoods that have sort of been forgotten and have huge gang and violence issues.
Wow.
And what I've been doing is linking up with groups, a biker group, a marching band, and a horse riding group in, you know, arguably two of the most dangerous neighborhoods in North America. And I, you know, basically amplified their story through the mural making and through a couple of zines. And then another friend of mine called Matthew Thorne, he followed me on a journey just like Tim did, but only over a four-week, very intense period, documenting the reaction with the community and with that work. Yeah, it's all, I'm just interested in telling stories, and if there's a social slant to it, I'm all for it.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you so much for not only that mural, but all the work you've done and this documentary. Congratulations on it. It's really, really good to watch. Anyone can watch it. It's up on SBS On Demand. It's even on the front page if you scroll down to the documentary area, or just do a search for Black Anzac and you'll find that documentary. It aired on NITV last week, I believe. But yeah, congratulations. Thank you so much for chatting to us here at 2SER, and good luck with everything in the future.
Thanks so much, Mick. Anytime.